Coming up on Harvard Chan This Week in Health, understanding the basic biology of some of the world's most prevalent diseases.
We cannot make sound preventive or therapeutic strategies or tools without really understanding the basic science, basic mechanisms that give rise to disease.
In this week's episode, an in-depth conversation with a scientist who is deepening our understanding of conditions like diabetes and heart disease and trying to find ways to treat or prevent them. Plus, he shares the challenges of running a lab that is trying to understand fundamental things about how our bodies work.
No matter how creative we try to become, our maximum level of creativity is far below the level of complexity of nature.
Hello and welcome to Harvard Chan This Week in Health. I'm Noah Levitt.
And I'm Amy Montemiro.
Non-communicable diseases, or NCDs, are the leading cause of death around the world. And of those NCDs, chronic cardiometabolic conditions, things like heart disease or diabetes, are particularly deadly.
These diseases are influenced by a variety of factors, our genes, our environment, our diet. But what's clear is that the burden of these conditions is growing. And while in the past they've been viewed as illnesses of affluence, there are rising rates of NCDs in low and middle income countries.
And in this week's episode, we're speaking with a scientist who is trying to understand the root causes of these diseases. What goes wrong at the cellular and molecular level to make us sick?
My name is Gökhan Hotamışlıgil. I'm James Simmons, Professor of Genetics and Metabolism at the Harvard THN School of Public Health.
Since 2014, Gökhan Hotamışlıgil has led the Sabri Ulker Center, which studies the basic mechanisms of a range of non-communicable diseases.
Their research has helped shed light on the molecular basis of obesity, diabetes, and other cardiometabolic disorders, as well as age-associated conditions like neurodegeneration. One of their key findings involved uncovering the role of something called the endoplasmic reticulum in protecting cells from shortages or surpluses of certain molecules.
I had the chance to sit down for a wide-ranging conversation with Hotamışlıgil, where we discussed the burden of cardiometabolic diseases, the importance of basic scientific research in treating and preventing these conditions, and the unique challenges of running a lab like the Sabri Ulker Center. Take a listen. Your lab focuses a lot of its research on cardiometabolic diseases, things like heart disease, diabetes. Why focus your research energy in those areas?
Well, I mean, from a impact perspective, these are the problems that that represents the greatest threat to global health in every part of the world. And so therefore, if you are really hoping to make an impact, these are, even if you make a small incremental impact, it is going to have a huge influence on the global scale. So from a discovery perspective, these are extremely challenging. There is no single explanation for any one of these diseases. So for some, this may actually be a reason to run away from these diseases. But I see that also as a great place of opportunity. If a problem is very complex and challenging, that means there's a lot of places that you can make exciting discoveries. So from both discovery perspective and impact perspective, these are very exciting problems to tackle.
And I want to talk a little bit more about the complexity in a few minutes, but when you talk about these being kind of huge global threats, I mean, what's the burden of these diseases? And are we seeing changes over time in who's being affected by these kinds of conditions?
Chronic non-communicable diseases, or the way I refer to them as chronic metabolic diseases, one important characteristic of these problems is that they don't come alone. They don't usually. I mean, occasionally they will come alone. But in overwhelming cases, they will come as clusters. So if you have diabetes, you'll have much more risk for cardiovascular disease. If you have cardiovascular disease, even some components of cardiovascular disease, you'll have a much higher risk for dementia, stroke. And if you have insulin resistance, you'll have higher likelihood of fatty liver disease, certain cancers, neurodegeneration, bone disease. So in a way, this cluster actually is very reminiscent of aging. So whatever happens during aging, all of these problems actually happen in the course of metabolic disease, except in a shorter period of time. It's almost an accelerated form of aging. And for this reason, of course, both is part of aging process itself, which is now one of the most important drivers of global health problems, changing demographics, changing the age distribution. And the cluster actually exposes people to multiple diseases, so that also increases the burden tremendously. So if you want to really understand, actually even beyond the importance of metabolic disease in isolation, to also tackle the issues related to aging, healthy aging, understanding these problems is fundamental. So in terms of burden, I mean, I can give you some numbers. You can give many numbers, but diabetes, for example, 1 out of every 10 individuals has diabetes. Right now, close to 500 million people on Earth have diabetes. Another 500 million have pre-diabetes. So that means within the next 25 years, it is possible, actually more than possible, that the diabetes numbers can double. And the majority of this, of course, comes from low and middle income countries. I mean, diabetes kills close to 5 million people every year. I mean, this burden just of diabetes is more than tuberculosis, malaria, HIV, infectious diarrhea, pneumonia combined and multiplied. I mean, cardiovascular disease is the number one cause of death globally. It kills 20 million people every year. 1 out of every 4 individual on Earth, 1 out of every 4 individual on Earth has fatty liver disease. And really, we are approaching really statistically so alarming place that the overwhelming majority of the people living on Earth will be suffering from one or multiple combinations of these problems.
This is, might be just kind of a big existential question, but I mean, you were just talking about kind of the scale of these conditions and kind of the tie into aging. I mean, are we investing enough in these conditions? I mean, like, are we doing enough to invest in studying these diseases?
Yeah, it's hard to say that as the burden of disease increase and spread. So it's not just really a problem of higher income countries anymore. Even, for example, in the past decade, diabetes incidence doubled in sub-Saharan Africa. And sub-Saharan Africa, there were countries with 0% diabetes. Now it's approaching 7.5-8% of the population with diabetes. And so far it's pretty clear in the majority of these diseases what we have used for preventive measures or to curb the pandemic is not very successful, because we cannot really stop the increase in disease except for very few examples. For example, in stroke, we've been successful in reducing, but what really comes as a very big surprise is now it started appearing in the young age. So we reduced the stroke in the classical age bracket, but now it started popping up at much higher rates in the younger generation. So we really have to fundamentally change the approach. But the unfortunate reality is government-based funding for these problems is not really increasing in proportion to the increase in challenge or the scale of the challenge. In some cases, it is even decreasing. And this is especially true for United States and Europe. And in some areas of the world, for example, in China, Singapore, Korea, there is, of course, huge investments into science. But there is another alarm for the governments to really realize. Because with respect to the total expenditure of economic scale like America, resource expenditure is nothing, really. It's a very small drop in the bucket, and it's very critical. But, I mean, life goes on, so we cannot really wait to pursue research and then wait for the governments to be enlightened and then, you know, put their actions together. The good thing is there's always a very nice balance. And so when the governments don't do the right thing, corporations do the right thing, individuals do the right thing, foundations do the right thing. So there's always a balance somewhat established in this equilibrium. And we actually also, we wouldn't be able to do what we are doing if it was only indexed to government funding. We would we wouldn't be able to do 10% of what we are doing right now. And we are able to enjoy this, I mean, long-term and deep analyses of these big problems because of Sabri Ülker Center, which was which became a reality because of the generosity of a family.
And you talked a little about the work you're doing, this kind of really deep analysis. So what are some of the big questions that you're trying to answer? I mean, you said a minute ago this kind of need to change the fundamental approach and how we look at these diseases. So what are some of the big questions that you and your lab are trying to answer about these conditions?
Yeah, so we are a basic science laboratory. And in our laboratory, our big goal is really to uncover the underlying mechanisms. So why a disease emerges? Why does it emerge so frequently? If half of the humans living on Earth are suffering one form of this disease, does that then relate to our biological infrastructure? Are there vulnerabilities in our biological infrastructure that is not in good match with the current chapter of human history, because it's very recent? I mean, compared to our biological infrastructure, our lifestyle and current chapter of human history is very young, and it has happened very rapidly. So when any structure is exposed to a dramatic and rapid change, there are cracks in the system. And so one possibility is that if we really examine our biological infrastructure and how we respond to things that are presenting risk, then we will be able to pinpoint where those vulnerabilities are and how really we can aim our interventions or preventive strategies to tackle those precise molecular mechanisms. Because in general, what I firmly believe is we cannot make sound preventive or therapeutic strategies or tools without really understanding the basic science, basic mechanisms that give rise to disease.
You spoke about the importance of kind of understanding the underlying mechanisms kind of causing a disease. But on the flip side, are you also looking at, when it comes to aging, for example, the mechanisms that maybe kind of promote healthful aging? So is that also part of the balance here of kind of understanding what is going right biologically in our bodies when we age in a healthful way?
Yeah, so the program that we are trying to build and execute here actually has two pillars. One big one is to understand the natural defenses that are built in human body, because human body is very resilient. And many of the things we believe are the stresses that set the stage for some of the diseases that we mentioned, like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, fatty liver disease, are also the stresses when we are exposed to them in a limited manner. We have wonderful defenses so that we can protect ourselves. Let me give you an example. For example, eating. Eating is a very stressful experience. In a very limited period of time, you consume large amount of nutrients and energy. So this actually engages a lot of systems to respond so that they can be properly metabolized, disposed to the proper places, if they are going to be stored in order, in a harmless manner, and the byproducts need to be neutralized. So how dramatic is this? For example, your pancreas need to produce liters of enzymes to deal with just your regular eating. Let's say you're a good, conscious kind of eater. You eat three times a day and in limited quantities. Just to deal with that, your organs need to remove huge amount of sugar and lipid from your bloodstream. to digest this, your pancreas needs to produce enormous amounts of active proteins and then go back to normal. So this is extremely challenging, but we can deal with this. I mean, if you were a snake, for example, a python, you have a much, much stronger version of this. You can sit down and eat 10 times your body weight. I mean, imagine eating 600 pounds of food in one sitting, in half an hour. But there is a creature who can do it and still live. But this can only happen once in 3 months. And if it happened every day, the python will get sick and die. Very similar analogy could be constructed for humans. So if you eat 10 times the calories that you're supposed to consume in much more frequent intervals, you don't exercise and burn energy, the existing defense system is not going to be enough. But it is there. So one really big area is if we find these things, define them molecularly, then maybe we can tickle them a little bit so that they defend the system better. So if we can scale this up a little bit, then we can increase the health span. And this will have, of course, great implications for age-related diseases. And so I'm actually, personally, I'm much more interested in living the same amount of time, but in a healthy manner, than much longer with the diseases. So if I was asked, I would say, okay, I'll take X amount of years healthy rather than 2X amount of years unhealthy. So it is a big part of what we're doing.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I think when a lot of people hear of treatment or therapy, they think, okay, it's a drug or a pill. But it sounds like what you're saying in a sense is if we can learn how the body naturally defends itself, we can kind of take lessons from that. Is that kind of what you're saying? Like learn what the body is already doing and see if we can just maybe tweak that to find ways to combat something like heart disease?
Yeah, I am saying that, except there's been a very important difference that in a very mechanistic and scientific manner. So that could give us actual results. So not conjecture or correlation or observational recommendations or interventions, but really things targeting specific molecular mechanisms involved in these responses. So yes, if we can tickle these mechanisms upward a little bit, we know that we can defend the organs and the systems better, and that upscaling can come from many angles. Some can come in the form of traditional medicines. So we find the molecule, we find a switch, and we use a molecule to turn the switch on. So there are examples of that. It is possible that it's not exactly an on-off switch, but it's a dimmer. And then, so that dimmer can be turned a little bit more gradually upwards or downwards by multiple things, including things that are found in our diet or things that we do as part of our daily lives. But only when we tie these together at the molecular level with definitive evidence, then we can make an effective recommendation. Otherwise, we make conjectural recommendations which do not in the long term be effective.
So, you know, you need to invest time in understanding the mechanism, you know, which may take a long time, but in the end that pays off in potentially a better treatment or intervention.
So better understanding, I have a very firm belief that will result in much more effective strategies to prevent or to treat or to reverse disease. Here also, I mean, even in the treatment area, if you think about all the diseases, there are very, very few diseases that we can treat and cure. So many of the things we can alleviate, delay, postpone, but not cure. There is not a single diabetes drug in the market, for example, that cures diabetes. So all the drugs actually alleviate high levels of blood glucose. So even in the drug discovery area, there are many examples that we haven't been able to reach the root causes. And in the preventive arena, the problem is even more challenging because for a long period of time, this has not really entered even the arena of preventive medicine. But this has now firmly and strongly entered, and this is the transformational force for global health practices. And so those who actually incorporate this into these into their schools and programs and companies and agencies and foundations and NGOs, they will turn out to be successful, and those who cannot will not. I mean, it's as simple as that.
So I know your lab has done a lot of recent work on cholesterol, for example. So is cholesterol an example where we're seeing this play out, where you're kind of looking to understand kind of how the body interacts with cholesterol at this basic molecular level? And what have you found in that regard?
Yeah, so when we were searching for this built-in mechanisms, we needed to develop a model, a place to ask this question, so that we can actually go after a potential defense mechanism or a switch or dimmer that tunes our responses. And one part of our program is very much interested in the function of small functional units within the cells called organelles. So those are like mini organs inside every cell that are charged with certain tasks. And there's one organelle called endoplasmic reticulum, which I refer to this as the master of all of the organelle or all of the mini functional units inside the cell, and also a place that is extremely critical in a cell's ability to monitor its metabolic environment, its food and carbon sources, and what kind of stress responses it should emanate to establish balance and health. And so the reason we're obsessed with this structure is because we think this is where you would find the most powerful defense mechanism, because this is like an octopus with millions of tentacles reaching every part of the cell and essentially all functional units of a cell. So when we were thinking about this, we realized that there's an important gap in management of one nutrient, one critical nutrient and building block in the cells, which is cholesterol. And so cholesterol is, on one hand, extremely essential. So a cell cannot function or even construct itself without cholesterol. On the other hand, it is a volatile molecule. It's very toxic and reactive. So the cell does not have tolerance to have free cholesterol molecules floating around, because they will cause a lot of damage. And so when we look at the approach to cholesterol homeostasis, the whole paradigm actually is built on the fact that cells need cholesterol. Therefore, when there is a reduction in the cholesterol, a mechanism kicks in to replenish it immediately. But we realize that the other side of the coin has an important knowledge gap, because the cell cannot drive its vehicles just by hitting the gas. It needs a brake, because if you push the cholesterol upwards, then how do you stop before it becomes generating its toxic effects? So we thought this was a good intellectual framework to look for that brake, and we thought this would be present in the endoplasmic reticulum, because this is a place where it can accommodate a sensor. And then it will be responsive to cholesterol, and then it will have the capability to launch an adaptive program or countermeasures to mitigate the toxic effects of cholesterol. There was a molecule sitting in the ER monitoring and sensing cholesterol, and when the cellular cholesterol reached a dangerous level, it gets activated and kicks in a program which neutralizes all the damaging effects of this. And very interestingly, so you ask me, why do you do basic science? How do you go from basic science and to something relevant to human disease and maybe a preventive or therapeutic measure? So in this case, of course, we are far from that. But even this basic discovery immediately helps us to make sense out of many things. For example, we know that in humans, there are mutations identified, genetic variations identified in this gene, which are also associated with the same metabolic problems that we observed in the cells. And then when we make these mutations in the animals develop a metabolic disease, and particularly, for example, a very severe form of fatty liver disease. In the liver and other metabolic problems if it spreads to other organs. So suddenly by identifying a molecule from a very basic question, I mean, you can immediately find the path to a condition in humans that creates metabolic problems, a combination of metabolic diseases. So the next step, of course, is very challenging. So, okay, we find the switch or the lever or the counter or the dimmer, whatever you call it, but how are we going to really develop the tools to manage this control mechanism? So that is, for example, now what we're working on in our lab, including understanding things that naturally engage this, including natural nutrients and metabolites. We're collaborating with industry to see if we can find ways to replenish this molecule. Because what's amazing is, if we take it in the preclinical setting, if we take the most severe form of fatty liver disease and then deliver this molecule through gene therapy right to the liver, in 2 weeks, that liver can turn into completely normal liver, with no sign of disease, no sign of inflammation, no sign of fibrosis, no sign of metabolic abnormalities, no sign of lipid accumulation. But can we translate this into humans? So we don't know the answer to this question, but we're, for example, at that stage, this is not something we can do here. So we form an alliance with industry. And I mean, this here, I have to also say, the one of the greatest things, at least in my experience in Harvard University, is the presence of Office of Technology Development. And so the group here, they have been so helpful for us. When we discover things like this, bring us together with the interested parties in industry. And then when we sit in the table, then we have the opportunity to form alliances. And they set the table for us. And I'm very grateful for that. And we had many successful examples of this.
This is obviously probably the major question, but I guess for someone who's really maybe not familiar with this process, what is the biggest barrier then from that step where, okay, we understand what's happening mechanistically, but we still are far away from a treatment? What is the biggest gap there? Is it finding an effective target? Is it finding a way to deliver a therapy? What is the biggest barrier there to bring you from the discovery to a treatment way down the line?
If we look at the general trends for a discovery and what kind of path it follows, you know, to reach an application, it greatly varies from one discovery to the other, one molecule to the other. So, for example, if you find a protein that controls an important process and you need to develop a new chemical to turn this protein on or off, which is basically the classic drug development framework, this is very challenging. It is very difficult to define how exactly you're going to do that, then find the molecules, make sure the molecules are consumable, safe, and effective, and then translate into clinical practice, especially for chronic diseases, which is a very, very, very big problem because of the cost of the clinical trials and approval process. So that is very challenging. Sometimes you find very easy things. I mean, for example, a number of years ago, we find a very simple lipid that has fascinating biology in the body. But this is one out of thousands of lipids. So it took us 15 years to find this lipid. And it took someone 3 months to produce and sell it. And it is now, without even going through any of the difficulties that I mentioned for a synthetic molecule, it is now sold. You can go and buy it if you want. So sometimes it's extremely fast. This is also unhealthy. And so the nature of the discovery really is a big determinant. So that's why actually, I mean, one of the things we really aim to do in the Sabri Ülker Center is to find a platform where we can find more of this kind of molecules. Simple molecules that are easy to make, safe to consume, and cheap for distribution to large sections of the society. But it requires a large investment and time-wise to really identify these needles in the haystack. It really varies, but we have to use multiple paths to you know, at least see one positive outcome from our life work. And so for many labs, this one lifetime or one professional lifetime is not enough to see the results of a discovery applied to a clinic. And so I feel we've been very fortunate, at least we are testing. So we haven't quite seen the use of it, but at least we have lived to see our discoveries actually being tested in humans. So my great hope is I will not die before I see at least the results, positive or negative. So not die in curiosity.
And so to jump off of that, I mean, I think there are, you mentioned these kind of finding these needles in haystacks combined with the complexity of each of these diseases. So how do you, as someone who's kind of leading a lab, how do you set your priorities? How do you kind of decide this is what we're going to investigate, this is what my scientists should be looking at? How do you balance all those priorities?
This is actually extremely challenging on one hand, very simple on the other hand. So every day, of course, we have a very high level of excitement, a big appetite about science. So we almost suffer from a scientific intellectual version of the chronic metabolic diseases that are related to excess. So we always live with this danger that our appetite is much larger than what we can actually manage and handle. But we try to, the way we deal with that is we always stay in the harbor. So we never really venture into the seas, but we let go some lines and then try to bring things, the treasures of the sea, into the harbor. So this is my main principle. So we have two main questions in this lab. And for 25 years, we have never departed from those two main questions. And so everything else that we ventured in the wild world, we tried to form some links with the main harbor. So that actually allowed us to make some advances in those major questions. And then, but at the same time, diversify our approach with these little lines that extended from the main core focus. But it is difficult because, I mean, science has become a very big enterprise. And many questions, I think there are no low-hanging fruits anymore. So all of those are collected. And it takes a tremendous amount of effort to understand the process, and it oftentimes attracts you to fields away from the harbor. So in those instances, of course, we also know that discoveries, you cannot make any discovery in your comfort zone. I mean, you have to get out of your comfort zone if you want to make a discovery. So we collaborate, and so we, rather than building platform after platform, expertise after expertise, so we have chosen to be very transparent about what we're doing. So we have a really good cohort of people that we trust, and both to their judgment and integrity, and we don't mind opening our discoveries or ongoing work to the world, and we collaborate. So these are some of the methods we use to prioritize. And then sometimes, of course, within these lines of activity, certain areas, because of our lack of imagination or lack of resource or lack of technology, we cannot make any advance. So they naturally kind of die out.
you mentioned a few minutes ago this idea that, you know, a lot of times when you start off, you know, an area of research, where you end up might be very different from where you started. I mean, I guess how do you kind of encourage the young scientists in your lab to kind of be open-minded in what they do, to kind of have a little almost creativity, if you will, and kind of as they're approaching their science?
Yeah, I don't have a, like, six C's of most creative scientist approach or anything of that nature. But there are some things that I strongly try to advocate in our environment. And the first thing is, you know, creativity does not come from the skies. And there's no mystical place where you go and drink from the fountain of creativity or the fifth dimension from which it will be transmitted to you. There is no such thing. And so the really, I mean, number one source of creativity is exposing yourself to the existing knowledge in different dimensions to the extent possible. So I mean, most of the things that we admire are product of extremely hard work. And I mean, oftentimes I give, for example, Michelangelo's products or the statue David. I mean, these things, yes, they're great, but they're not produced in a month. And people spend 5, 6, 7 years carving a piece of stone to produce a masterpiece. And science is no different. And so that means people really need to do a tremendous amount of reading, talking, exposure to different fields so that you can actually find where the interesting things at the juncture of the fields. And so most often this is where you find sources of creativity and talking to your friends and colleagues. And the second is actually, the second principle is, no matter how creative we try to become or how creative we believe we truly are, our maximum level of creativity is far below the level of complexity of nature. And therefore, it is only a fool's game to predict what is really happening inside a cell, inside an organ, inside an organism or human body. And therefore, I think number one productive path for science is to get used to failure. Or to get really, even I say actually, enjoy being wrong. Because if you don't enjoy being wrong, then you won't be able to learn from the greatest creative source and complexity, which is biology itself. So how can we then learn? So this is really the teaching of science, in my view, is you really need to learn to look into your experiments and then listen, hear, see what the experiment is telling or showing you, and how can you do that? This is a place where you can control. So you can control experiments. So you can set up your experiments so that you control as many variables as you can, so that you can actually hear the voice or see the picture. So this is something, for example, that is very important, and this is what a scientist can do. And the more objectively you can look into your experiment, the better chances that you will learn something very interesting about biology that you were not able to imagine in the first place.
It's almost like this idea that failure isn't necessarily a bad thing. Like, I mean, it might be bad in the moment, but it seems like invariably you'll learn something from your failures.
Oh, I mean, failure is not even a good word actually for science, because science is a task of impossibility. It's extremely frustrating. And I mean, you're really trying to conquer something that is not possible to conquer. And so failure is given. I mean, I think it's not a consideration. I think I'm more enjoying it or getting really frustrated beyond productivity is the distinction I'm trying to make. So being wrong is given. Are you able to enjoy this? is the issue.
So going from that note to the question where I wanted to ask, I mean, you've been you've now been doing this work for 25 years now. I mean, you've talked a lot about kind of the potential stress involved, I guess. But so what excites you most about going to the lab every day? I mean, as you continue to do this work, is it working with young scientists, or is it that possibility of kind of uncovering something new about nature? What excites you most?
Yeah, so I think at different stages of life, I probably have different answers for this. It also, of course, like ideas not coming from the sky. Scholars also don't fall from the sky. I mean, you start as a green fruit, and hopefully you ripe a little bit over the course. So, and this is very small. I mean, think about an apple. It will take 50 years to grow, and then one bite to consume. So this is what a scientist is. So at different stages, there are different priorities. And then now I feel like I'm not so green as I was maybe a while ago. So I am learning to appreciate and enjoy different things about science and find different sources of excitement. But one thing that doesn't change is this small hope that you will see something something for the first time, or something that hasn't been seen or known before. I mean, however insignificant or unimportant that might be, or nobody may care about it, but it's exciting. It's a privilege that doesn't exist in any other. It is difficult to enjoy this, I have to say. I mean, this is a little bit romantic way of talking about science, but scientific practice it can be extremely unpleasant and stressful and frustrating. But at this stage in my career, what excites me the most actually is the people. And people in two ways. One is maybe unlike most other professions, if not all other professions, science is a place where people can unite and pay little dividends to their differences, whether they're ethnic differences, religious differences, gender issues, political, social, lifestyle, whatever, that people discriminate each other relentlessly. There is one area which, with a little bit hope to overcome this, is science. And this is one tremendous pleasure. I mean, when you go to lab, you find all kinds of people that can overcome what they bring as their cultural or national or religious baggages and leave them at the door and, you know, and enter and unite. So this, I am absolutely fascinated. And I feel that maybe especially today, where everything is so polarized, there is nothing more really powerful than science to overcome those polarizations and unite. And I live that through, I mean, daily in my life, which I enjoy very much. But even more important than that is really these people, you have the opportunity to touch someone's life and change its trajectory. So maybe it's a function of aging, but mentoring has become the highest really source of gratification for me. And in many ways, and in also some selfish ways, because I realize that I won't be able to finish the project that I have started ever. No one will ever finish it. And so rather than focusing on my unit of success, so if I think about the problem, the more people you put on this problem, the more likely that one day it will be solved, or one day one of these people will make impact. So I think maybe to conclude, the greatest privilege for a scientist is to be shielded from this brutal world a little bit, so that actually he or she can focus on science itself, and in not a daily, monthly, yearly basis, but for a longer period of time, and with sufficient power. And this is where I want to come back to the importance of the center for us And the people who support science actually can make this possible. And the best example is Sabri Ülker Center. So having this center gives us this opportunity so that we don't always have to describe what exactly we're going to do to funding agencies, but venture into a little bit uncomfortable or uncertain paths. And so this is a very critical thing, and I feel very privileged and extremely grateful to enjoy this opportunity. And maybe lastly, you don't really have to be a scientist to love science. So there are many ways of loving science. And so this also is a great way of loving science and advancing science and supporting science. And we have been fortunate to do it.
That was my conversation with Gökhan Hodamishlagil about the basic scientific research being conducted at his lab, the Sabri Ülker Center.
If you want to learn more about Hodamishlagil's work and the work of this lab, we'll have much more information on our website, hsph.me/thisweekinhealth.
That's all for this week's episode. A reminder that you can always find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify.